From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Co-writing and co-starring in the heavy metal spoof This Is Spinal Tap was good preparation for Christopher Guest's new movie. Guest has just directed his first feature film called The Big Picture, and this time the subject of his satire is the movie industry itself. Today on Fresh Air, Guest tells us about his own movie and music experiences. Also, journalist Alec Wilkinson reports on his investigation into the sugarcane industry in Florida. He calls working conditions there a form of modern-day slavery. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by two bands, Webb Wilder and Billy Hill. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Among School Children, Tracy Kidder's year-long account at an inner-city elementary school. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Former HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce, at the center of a fraud scandal at his agency during the Reagan administration, today canceled his plans to testify before a House subcommittee tomorrow. Pierce had earlier delayed his appearance, saying he couldn't find a lawyer. Now he says he won't talk because he hasn't had time to prepare. The committee wants to question Pierce about a number of controversial decisions, including his lifting restrictions on a HUD lender after he was lobbied by former HUD Secretary Carla Hills, and his overruling career experts in favor of financing a project backed by a former law partner. President Bush announced today a doubling of food aid for Poland in the coming fiscal year. The announcement came late this afternoon at the White House. NPR's Jim Angle has details.
In a written statement, the president said the United States would provide an additional $50 million in food aid, bringing the U.S. total to $100 million for the next fiscal year. The president said the new aid would provide Poland with meat, corn, butter, cotton, and rice, among other things, and just in time for the difficult winter months, he said. Mr. Bush pointed out this aid package will work in tandem with $140 million of agricultural aid pledged by the European community, and he said the aid would support the long-term reform of the Polish agricultural system. The additional $50 million in food aid comes on top of $119 million in assistance announced earlier this summer. Less than half that was for food. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
As the exodus of East Germans to the West continues, East German leaders are taking the offensive against what they call a campaign of defamation from abroad. And one official has issued the first comment on the health of ailing East German leader Erich Honecker. The BBC's Ben Bradshaw reports from Berlin.
The economic spokesman in East Germany's Politburo, Günter Mittag, told a gathering of workers in East Berlin that Erich Honecker was well and would be back at work soon. The speech contained the first official comment on the 77-year-old leader's condition since rumors about his health began some weeks ago. At the same conference, another Politburo member said that East Germany had had to put up with 40 years of defamation and agitation, but its enemies still hadn't succeeded in throwing doubt on the competence of the working class leading a country for the good of the people. In another speech, the country's leading ideologist attacked those who maintained the German question was still open. He described what he called the bastion of socialism in East Germany as a thorn in the flesh of all those reactionary, conservative, and neo-Nazi powers in the West who wanted to turn back the wheel of history.
Ben Bradshaw of the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 14 points to close at 2664.89. Declines led advances 11-4. This is NPR News. A man described as emotionally disturbed shot and killed seven people and wounded 14 co-workers with an AK-47 assault rifle today in Louisville, Kentucky. Police say Joe Westbecker then turned another gun on himself, becoming the eighth person to die. Westbecker was described as a disgruntled employee, outraged at being called back to work from a long-term disability leave. The killings drew immediate outrage and calls for a ban on all rapid-fire military-style weapons. Soviet reformer and political maverick Boris Yeltsin met for the first time today with former President Ronald Reagan. The two met at St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota, where the former president is recovering from brain surgery. Mary Lozier from Minnesota Public Radio reports.
The meeting, which lasted about 40 minutes, was closed to the press, but Yeltsin spoke before and afterwards with reporters. Speaking through a translator, he said his visit with Reagan was mostly a courtesy call to wish the former president a speedy recovery.
произошло как раз именно в это время.
Because I have a very high regard for him, for one thing, and for another, because during the time he was president, he and Gorbachev signed and agreed to a great many agreements, which were the first step in the gradual improvement of the relations between our two countries.
The outspoken reformer said he told Reagan that the process must be completed by President Bush and Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. Yeltsin is on a whirlwind 8-day tour of the United States. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Lozier in Rochester.
The House Ways and Means Committee today approved a tax cut for capital gains over the objections of Democratic leaders. The proposal, which liberals claim is a giveaway to the rich, passed on a vote of 19-17 as 6 conservative Democrats sided with 13 Republicans on the panel. The plan would reduce the maximum rate on profits from sales and assets from the current 33%. I'm Frank Stasio, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the rock documentary spoof, This is Spinal Tap, Christopher Guest played a brain-dead heavy metal guitarist. In The Princess Bride, he was the sadistic Count. And as a cast member of Saturday Night Live, he compared self-inflicted injuries with Billy Crystal and said, "I hate it when I do that." Christopher Guest is now making his debut as a feature film director with a film he co-wrote called The Big Picture. Kevin Bacon stars as a film school graduate who thinks he's hot stuff when he's wooed by Hollywood agents and studio execs. Bit by bit, they corrupt his arty ambitions until he finds himself pitching story ideas about beach parties and hot stewardesses. The execs Guest had to pitch his film to are the same kinds of people he spoofs. I asked him how he went about pitching his story ideas.
The usual way, you know, you go into an office at one of the studios and you sit down and you tell them your movie and they have a very blank expression on their face. And then they ask you to leave. This happened at a lot of places. One studio, Paramount, said, go ahead and write the script. And we wrote the script and then they didn't think it was such a good idea after all. And then David Putnam read it and said, I'd like to make this movie. And briefly what happened is... After getting a go-ahead on a film, you begin the process, and there's a certain amount of momentum. And we started, and he was, in 2 weeks, he was gone. And then what happened is, because the movie is, in fact, about this, there was a transition at the studio. A different executive took over, a woman, just as it is in the script, in fact. So it was something written beforehand that was now happening to me. And this was interesting. But that's basically it.
Did you go through meetings like the Kevin Bacon character does in which the studio guys are taking your ideas and trying to make them better with their own ideas?
No, well, not really,
adding your own ideas to it. Uh-huh.
Those meetings are a composite of many meetings I've had in 15 or 16 years mm-hmm. that I've done this, whatever this is, this in quotations. And I haven't actually had that happen to me. Ironically, in the making of this movie, it's a small film, we were left alone. So I didn't actually go through the same mm-hmm. thing that Kevin goes through in the film. But I have had meetings that are that odd and that surreal. And I wanted to show that.
Would you describe one of those meetings?
A real meeting or the meeting
in
the film?
A real absurd meeting.
Well, I can't really describe it any better than what's in the film. Basically, you know, you bring in an idea and you say, you know, I'd like to make a film about a rodeo, and the next sentence is, you know, could we do it on the beach? And you say, well, what do you mean? And they say, well, you know, it would be a good idea to do it on the beach. And, you know, you say, well, there's these two characters. There's a black woman and she's married to a Frenchman. And they say, well, could they be Americans? And white. I mean, it's quite arbitrary that the changes. I couldn't possibly get any more surreal than what's in the film, and that actually has happened. So,
Martin Short has a great small part in it as an agent. His performance is basically uncredited. I can't remember if at the very end there's a credit for him or not.
Well, it's not basically uncredited. It's actually uncredited.
Uncredited, right? Yeah. I couldn't remember.
It's kind of one or the other. Yeah, a lot of people do favors for people when they. Martin's a friend of mine, and I think what happens is you don't want to make it seem like it's his film because he's well-known, and Billy Murray did that in Tootsie, and several other actors have done it recently, where you just sort of do that, and again, it's not his movie, it's Kevin Bacon's movie, and I guess they didn't want that confusion to make it seem like it was a Martin Short film.
Uh-huh. So does this mean he doesn't get paid for it with this kind of rate?
Oh, no, 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 he gets paid. But again, it's, you know, he did 2 days of work, that's all he did, and it was all those people like John Cleese and Roddy McDowall, it's basically a favor because we didn't have a large budget, so they just came in for a day or two at the most, and that was the situation.
When you started to direct this movie, did you find yourself going back to other movies to watch, to start watching movies in a new way?
No, not really, because when I had been working as an actor in films, and I had also been interested in photography for a long time, and I guess it was always a part of my awareness when I was on a set in terms of how they were lighting it and how they were shooting certain things, and it was, I guess, an organic kind of progression for me to start directing. So, no, I don't think so.
Christopher Guest is my guest, and he has a new movie that he both co-wrote and directed. It's called The Big Picture, and it stars Kevin Bacon. Now, your co-writer, one of your co-writers on this, is Michael McKean, with who you co-starred in This is Spinal Tap, which was a spoof of heavy metal documentaries. And you played a brain-dead lead guitarist. How did you develop that character?
It wasn't much to develop. I just... that's really me. Well, I had spent time in England. My dad is English, and although he's not that kind of English. And I'd been playing music with Michael McKean for many years in bands in New York and elsewhere. And I started developing this guy, I guess, in the mid-70s and fooling around with the idea of playing somebody like this. And then when I was living at this hotel in Los Angeles when I first moved out there called the Chateau Marmont, I saw a band arrive. I was standing at the desk for some reason, and this heavy metal band showed up to stay there. And there was a great scene that sort of prompted this whole movie for me, which was the bass player couldn't find his instrument. They were checking in, and the manager said,
you know, where's your bass?
And he said, I don't know. I think I left it at the airport.
You left your bass at the airport?
Yeah, well, I don't know where it is, do I? And it was this was played out of about 15 minutes where he was in such a daze, he didn't even know where his instrument was. And it was this, I got very inspired by that little moment of pathos, I guess.
I want to play a very short clip from the movie, and this is part of the film where the director, Rob Reiner, is interviewing you.
Do you feel that in collaboration with David, that you are afforded the opportunity to express yourself musically the way you would like to?
Well, I think I do, you know, in my solos. Yeah. My solos are my trademark.
Well, that's a great solo you're playing there. Did you do your own music for the film?
Yes, we did. That was played live, in fact, at a venue. I think it was in the Valley. We shot at a number of different theaters. Yes, Michael McKean and Harry Shearer and I wrote all the music and played it and produced the album subsequently. And then we went on an actual tour of America after the film had come out. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
What were some of the stadium rock gestures that you knew you wanted to get in your character?
Well, I mean, we went to see a bunch of heavy metal bands, and we actually started playing around L.A. even before we started shooting the film, just to see what that was like. And they're rather limited. I mean, this isn't, you know, like a repertory company thing happening here. I mean, it's either you're shoving your fist in the air or you're grabbing your groin. It's kind of one or the other. And you turn around and you kind of moon people and you stick your tongue out. And it just kind of comes naturally when you're standing in front of a lot of people. The last gig we played was in Seattle. There were 15,000 people. And then it was that weird thing where the line is now being crossed into reality because they were screaming and jumping up and down. And we thought, well, is this real now?
Did you ever study music?
Apparently, yeah. I went to the High School of Music and Art in New York City. I studied classical music and eventually started getting into country music, the natural progression, of course, from studying clarinet. I started playing the mandolin, and I played guitar with Arlo Guthrie because we went to the same school. And then I started playing in bluegrass bands and then rock and roll after that.
Well, I guess that diversity gave you the kind of background you needed to write all the song parodies for National Lampoon that you wrote.
Yeah, it did. We did some country music, some rock and roll, and it did. I really felt secure in a number of different kinds of music that I felt I could do that. And that was a great opportunity at the Lampoon because we had our own studio, and every week for the radio show, which ultimately was made into albums, we could do new material. Yeah. And Michael McKean and I, in fact, write a song for The Big Picture, the Pez People song, people dressed as Pez dispensers.
Right. Of all the song parodies that you've written, does one of them still really stay with you as being a really decent song, if you know what I mean?
Well, you know, what's interesting is when people hear... I did a show called Lemmings. It was off-Broadway, and it ran for about a year with Chevy Chase and John Belushi. And in that show, I did James Taylor and Bob Dylan, and other people were done in the show. And people would come up and say, how did you get the rights for the music? You know, they understood that the words were different, which was a great compliment, because actually the music was original and really stood on its own, but they were just listening to the words, and the music was obviously derivative intentionally, but that was one of their questions a lot.
Well, let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is Christopher Guest. He's an actor, screenwriter, and now film director. His new movie, which he co-wrote and directs, is called The Big Picture. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Christopher Guest is with us. His new movie is called The Big Picture. He co-wrote and directs it. Let's talk about your part in the movie The Princess Bride. You were the evil count in that film. Why were you cast in that role?
Why was I cast?
Yeah, in that role. In that role.
It was a bet. Well, I've been friends with Rob Reiner for a long time, and this was one of his favorite books that William Goldman had written, The Princess Bride, and he showed me the script, and he said, "How about this?" And I said, "Great. I like playing villains. It's usually pretty juicy, and this was particularly twisted, so I kind of liked it. And there was an opportunity to work with some friends and ride a horse and go to England for 3 months. So it sounded like a good idea at the time, and in retrospect, I'm glad I did it. I like the film.
Well, I want to play a scene from The Princess Bride.
Okay.
In which our hero is locked in your torture chamber.
Ooh.
And you're about to test out your latest creation on him.
Beautiful, isn't it? Took me half a lifetime to invent it. I'm sure you've discovered my deep and abiding interest in pain. Present, I'm writing the definitive work on the subject. So I want you to be totally honest with me on how the machine makes you feel. This being our first try, I'll use the lowest setting.
I love the way you play it. You really play it like a man of refinement who's become a connoisseur of torture and pain.
Yes, I thought it was interesting to have a certain detachment about that. I thought that was scarier, and I didn't want to make him nice in any way. I thought that was important, that even though this was a comedy in a sense, I really wanted to make him unrelentingly nasty.
Mm-hmm. Have period films or epic movies been an influence on you at all? Did you enjoy them when you were young?
I guess I did. I guess, yeah. I don't know about epic movies, but I certainly like period films. History has always interested me, so I guess, yes.
What were the movies that you think helped create your fantasy life when you were young?
What fantasy life? it's so hard. Sherlock Holmes was a big influence on me. There's something, Basil Rathbone was one of my early heroes. And I think movies about Romans and those, I mean, they're kind of cheesy to look at now, but people in chariots with hats, with feathers, running around with swords interested me. The Three Musketeers. Again, these are movies made in the 30s and 40s that I probably saw on television as a kid, rather than the movies that were actually out in the theaters when I was going to the movies, which were movies like The Tingler, which didn't really impress me or affect my fantasy life, except for last night. So I guess that's the answer to that.
You were on Saturday Night Live for a year with Billy Crystal and Martin Short. It's my understanding that you were asked to be on that show before that year. I forget, was it 84? I forget what this season was. But
we were on in 84 and 85. Mm-hmm. I was asked a year or so before that to be on.
Why didn't you want to do it?
Well, it just didn't seem like the right time to do it. It was one of these convergences. The year we did do it, Billy Crystal wanted to do it. Martin Short, Harry Shearer, and I basically all agreed as a group, in a sense, that, well, if you're doing it, I'll do it. We all basically had one-year contracts. We said we'd just do it for 1 year, and it was a little different because we came in with having had some experience, so we were allowed to have some control over what we were doing, and that's how that came to be.
You know, it's funny, when I think of Billy Crystal, I think of certain characters when I think of Saturday Night Live, likewise with Martin Short. And when I think of your appearances on Saturday Night Live, I think of all the characters who I'd look at and I'd say, who is that? And I'd say, oh, it's Christopher Guest. You'd really, like, lose yourself in the character a lot of times. And you didn't do the same number of recurring characters, you know, the character mm-hmm. who's on and does a similar shtick, you know, in the same persona every week.
Well, to me, acting is just, I mean, they have this odd term in this country, character actor. I don't know, it's sort of redundant, I suppose. I think I very much like to be other people when I'm acting. I think that's the point. There are certain people who, a movie star is someone who I think hopefully can act, but also gives the audience some comfort because you always know that that's that person. And that's not what I do. I like to put on a hat and a nose and as you say, get lost. I mean, mm-hmm. literally get lost.
One of the recurring characters that you did do was the thing with Billy Crystal where you would talk about basically self-inflicted injuries and say, I hate it when that happens.
Right.
How did that that running sketch come about?
Well, it's funny how these things evolve, or maybe it's not. I shouldn't be presumptuous. Maybe it's not that funny. Years and years ago, I was fooling around with a friend of mine, Tom Leopold, who's a very funny writer and actor, and it was kind of just something that we would all do socially, where, you know, he would take a staple gun and hold it up to his ear and say, boy, this really hurts. And we'd say, well then don't do that. You shouldn't do that, you see. And it evolved through this into Billy and I just sitting around the office one day and coming up with these characters who weren't terribly intelligent and just who would go out of their way to come up with these things. Like, you know, you know what I hate is, and they would fill in each other's sentences, which I guess was part of the funny thing. He said, yeah, you mean when you take a shrimp fork and jam it up your nose? You know, it was that kind of thing. I hate when I do that. And it was just this litany of things with wood-burning tools and various things. And I guess that's how it started, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've written a lot of comedy in conjunction with other people. You know, like your new movie's co-written. You co-wrote Spinal Tap. You co-wrote the sketch you were just telling us with Billy Crystal.
Right.
Do you find it easier to write that way?
Well, yes, much easier. Because I perform a lot of the things I write, it's very much of a different process than a novelist or writer that sits alone and types. First of all, I don't type, so there's a major drawback. But I really need something to bounce off of, and I very much live the character who's speaking, and that's my writing process. In the film I've just written, it was different and more difficult because it's a sustained script, and the characters have to evolve, hopefully. And but I still worked in conjunction with Michael Varhol and Michael McKean.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to your new movie, The Big Picture.
Okay.
As an actor yourself, who was making his debut as a director, did you find it hard or easy to direct the actors in your movie? Did you know what you wanted right away and how to communicate that to the actors?
Well, I did, actually. Again, having acted for a long time, I felt pretty much at ease with conveying what I wanted. And again, because I was involved in the writing of it, I very much was connected to certainly the Kevin Bacon character in terms of sensibility. And in casting Kevin Bacon, I was really confident that he could bring that out, and I feel he really did. I think it's a wonderful piece of work that he's done in the film.
I know this is a kind of vague question, but what were you like in high school? What were you doing in high school? Were you playing in bands? Were you studious? Were you did you have a lot of friends?
Well, it was kind of schizophrenic, I guess. I was playing in bands, and at the same time, I was involved in sports. So it was kind of a weird paradox. I was a captain of the ski team and played tennis, and then I would be in these bands. And I did have friends. I had a lot of friends, but those groups of friends would never know each other. So it was kind of, that was split up. It was kind of odd because the people who skied invariably didn't want to hang out with the musicians and vice versa. So that was sort of a pattern for a while until I met some of my closer friends, Michael McKean and people that I have collaborated with for a long time, where there was an overall kind of connection where that sort of sets the pattern for your adulthood, I guess.
You say all these different groups that you were friends with wouldn't get along well with each other. Did you change yourself depending on which group you were with at the time? Did you have different characters,
do you think? That's a good question. I don't really know. I'm not sure if I don't know, not consciously. I don't remember consciously doing that. I still have a very wide variety of interests. You know, I go up to the mountains with my wife Jamie and our daughter, and I'm very happy being there for months at a time, fishing and skiing, and with no thought of anything else. And I don't know many people who go back and forth between the two, in other words, whatever this is, show business or whatever, and that other thing. So that's just sort of another world for me, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. You've done so many parodies of rock songs and rock bands. Did you ever have a fantasy of being a rock star yourself?
I don't know. Maybe very early on, maybe when I was 15 or something. I guess when you're playing in a band, you must think that. But I also remember thinking, the Beatles had come out and I was just starting to play, and I remember thinking, well, there's just no way. I mean, this is just too hard to follow here. And I'd always done funny things, I suppose, or comedy in some sense, even from when I was small. And it just naturally evolved that I was going to combine that with music. So that just then had its own life, where I would combine two things I liked, playing music and comedy.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Christopher Guest, and his new film, The Big Picture, which he co-wrote and directed, is a satire about Hollywood, and it opens tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, feminist writer Barbara Ehrenreich, her new book, The Inner Life of the Middle Class, explores the myths and anxieties that have shaped the middle class's view of itself. She looks at the portrayal of the middle class in films, TV shows, literature, food, clothing, and leisure time activities. I hope you can join us.
Coming live direct from hell, Spinal Tap.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The sugarcane industry is one of the most powerful and least examined industries in the U.S. New Yorker staff writer Alec Wilkinson went to Florida to investigate reports of exploitative working conditions in the sugarcane fields. Coming up, he tells us what he discovered. Also, reviews of new albums by Webb Wilder and Billy Hill. Rock critic Ken Tucker says they have something in common. They're both eccentric. Tracy Kidder, the author of The Soul of a New Machine, spent a year observing a successful elementary school teacher to try to discover what she does right. Critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the book which resulted. It's called Among School Children. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Shots rang out in a printing company plant in Louisville, Kentucky today as a gunman opened fire on workers, killing 7 people with an assault rifle before killing himself. 14 people were wounded and 5 of them are in critical condition. The gunman has been identified by officials as 47-year-old Joseph Westbecker, who was on permanent disability from the plant. John Tingle knew Westbecker.
He had a nervous problem and he had chemical despondency over here. The chemicals we used and that was irritating his skin and that, and he felt that he should have been out, retired, and done, you know. And that's why it all come down, really.
The mayor of Louisville, Jerry Abramson, went to the scene of the mass killing and said it took a long time to find all the victims.
I got on the scene 45 minutes after it had begun, and an hour after that, we were still finding individuals because the facility is an old factory, and it has all sorts of crooks and crannies, and every time you'd make a turn or go up the stairs, you'd find another body or another injured victim.
One employee of the company said that Westbecker had been talking about this for a year. Former HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce has canceled an appearance before a congressional committee tomorrow. He had been scheduled to testify before a panel looking into scandals at the agency that he led during the Reagan administration. Pierce says that he has not had time to prepare for his appearance and that he's willing to testify later. The U.S. and the Soviet Union are apparently on the verge of an agreement to disclose and verify their chemical weapons. As NPR's David Mopus reports, it could be a first step toward a chemical weapons ban.
The agreement is expected to be signed next week by Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze and Secretary of State Baker. Administration sources say it would require both sides to exchange information on some, but not all, of their chemical weapons and agree to on-site inspections to verify the data. If this trial run goes smoothly, officials say, it would be followed by another agreement requiring full disclosure of the Soviet and American chemical arsenals. The central obstacle to a treaty banning chemical weapons has been a lack of complete information about each side's capabilities. Analysts say if the two sides can agree on what each other has, the way would be cleared for actual reductions to begin. But some disagree. Former Arms Control Director Kenneth Edelman says a verifiable chemical treaty is not possible because the weapons are too easy to hide. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
Hurricane Hugo is gaining strength as it moves westward across the Atlantic toward the Leeward Islands. The storm now has winds of up to 85 miles an hour. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 14.5 points to close at 2,664.89. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Two new albums from two very different southern bands have caught the ear of rock critic Ken Tucker. One's the debut album of a country group called Billy Hill. The other's a more raucous rock-country blend from Webb Wilder.
Somehow I got the notion we have a thing in motion. Now you say it's history. Was it something I said?
Webb Wilder is my kind of pop music eccentric, hard to pin down but easy to listen to. Let's begin with the name. Webb Wilder is certainly the moniker of the man who's just released an album called Hybrid Vigor. He's a tall, stately fellow with those so-dorky-their-hip steel-rim glasses. He sings idiosyncratic rock songs with a Hattiesburg, Mississippi drawl. But Webb Wilder is also the name of Webb Wilder's band, a trio so tight they sound like triplets. The album title Hybrid Vigor is an accurate description of this music. Webb Wilder seizes on country, blues, and rockabilly to liven up standard-issue rock and roll. They play this music as if it didn't have a half century of history behind it.
Saw the ad in the paper, set the hill with it all, took the gig with the circus and the human cannonball. Tell your jacket really gets me off. I live in a tent with the world's strongest man. When I met the mother, like it broke my hand. My baby, she's a lady in the high wire act. When I'm feeling tense, she walks on my back. Now the bear's okay, the benefits are great. I get to shoot the bull with the world's smartest ape. I'm the human cannonball.
Webb Wilder is one of those obsessives who likes to drift into the absurd with a deadpan face. As that song goes on, the human cannonball ends up talking about serious matters with Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. If David Lynch, director of Eraserhead and Blue Velvet, had created a rock band, it would be Webb Wilder. In fact, Webb Wilder has already created the sort of music video that David Lynch might shoot. It's an eerie black-and-white featurette called Webb Wilder Private Eye that pops up on cable channels late at night occasionally. As luck would have it, there's another new band around that refers to itself by a proper name. The quintet called Billy Hill doesn't contain anyone named Billy Hill. It's an oddball country outfit that just now has a pretty big novelty hit with this song called Too Much Month at the End of the Money.
Yes, I paid the bank note, the car note, and yes, I paid the phone bill too. And then I turned around and I found that the house note's due. Yeah, I'd love to take you out like I said I would, honey, but there's too much month at the end of the money.
Unlike Webb Wilder, which exists on the fringes of the music world looking for a break, Billy Hill is a bunch of insiders looking for a lark and a quick buck. They're Nashville session musicians and songwriters. For example, members of Billy Hill wrote American Made, a perfectly dreadful, huge hit song by the perfectly dreadful Oak Ridge Boys. As a group, however, Billy Hill is a lot of fun. The band calls its debut album I'm Just a Rebel, but rebels are the last thing these guys are. They're pros out to stake out a career. With Webb Wilder, you get the feeling he'd be acting eccentrically even if no one took any notice. With Billy Hill, you know eccentricity is an act. But it's a good act, one in which professionalism has resulted in something more than slickness. This sort of thing reaches its high point on a song called Rollin' Dice. I don't know where this song came from. Its dark, obsessive edge doesn't jibe with the playful tone of the rest of the album. The song sounds like a cross between Little Feat and Lynyrd Skynyrd, a chunk of southern rock that's at once catchy and brooding. It's the sort of song that can make an eccentric band's career.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Farm workers enjoy Florida sunshine during the winter months. So reads a 1941 poster recruiting workers to cut sugarcane in the fields of Florida. The poster promised good wages, good living conditions, free transportation, and meals. But the people who went to work found the sugar company didn't deliver on its promises. The workers were charged for their transportation and tools and arrived at the camp already in debt. They were hunted down if they tried to escape. Complaints to the FBI resulted in a 1943 grand jury indictment charging the U.S. Sugar Corporation with conspiracy to commit slavery. Eventually, the indictment was dismissed on a technicality. But the next year, the industry shifted its recruitment efforts from Americans to West Indians. Journalist Alec Wilkinson updates the story in his new book, Big Sugar. Wilkinson is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and spent 4 years researching his book. He focuses on what he calls the epic story of the workers, not on the growers and sugarcane lobby. I asked him what drew him to the story in the first place.
Well, I had heard that down in Florida there were a collection of black men doing essentially what, and not a small collection, but 10,000 black men doing what amounted to slave work, that they were migrant workers, and that it was supposed to be the most dangerous work in America and also the most difficult to do. And so I really just went down to take a look at that time for The New Yorker for a piece to see what was down there.
Now, I think you made initial contact through the Florida Sugarcane League, which is the lobby
right.
and PR group of the sugar industry in Florida. Were they cooperative?
They told me on my very first day there that I would... Actually, I hadn't even got there yet. It was over the telephone. Called them from New York, and they said the woman, who was otherwise quite pleasant, said that I would never meet a sugarcane cutter or visit a sugarcane camp. So they weren't the most generous of hosts in all areas, but they were welcoming in others.
When you tried to actually see sugarcane workers in the fields and then talk to them outside of their work, how did you get access?
Mainly over a long period of time. I mean, the in the end, I finally met one person who introduced me to another and another and finally to quite a number. But it took a long time to meet the one. I tried all sorts of schemes to try and get myself into sugarcane camps, including impersonating a peddler, selling cigarettes, and doing various other things that I thought would work, but none of which came to anything.
So how did you actually meet somebody?
I actually got an introduction to a guy who, an ex-convict who was called Caveman. And Caveman would take me around to the camps, and we would visit, and I had a Polaroid camera also, and I had been told at the Florida Sugarcane League that one of the reasons that they would not be able to permit me to visit the cutters was that I had a camera and that the cutters abhorred having their picture taken. And it turned out that there's probably, so far as I could tell, few things in life they like more than having their pictures taken. And I would take their pictures and give them copies. And at a certain point, I just simply, after I'd got to know enough of them, said on one occasion, I was in a camp and I was sitting down on a bed and there were about 20 of them around me, and I put the camera down. And I said, it's time for you to tell me about sugarcane. And I reached over into my knapsack and take out my notebook to write down what they said. And I looked up, and there was one man standing there, and he was the man on whose bed I was sitting. and from, you know, from him I met others.
Did people think you might be a spy for the industry?
I think they probably thought all kinds of things, and it doesn't reflect all that well on my cunning, but it took me a long time to figure out that I thought the simple, I'm used as a reporter to simply dealing straightforwardly to people and saying, I'm doing a piece about, in this case, sugarcane cutting, can I ask you some questions? But naturally, there's so much intrigue around that and secrecy around that industry that probably made them think I was anything but who I said I was. So I had a lot of, cutters have been warned by the growers and by the Sugarcane League, do not speak to reporters. And so it was very hard, and it was also, from a moral point of view, difficult to talk to them because you had to get them away from the camp or somewhere in secret because I work by taking notes and writing down what people say and having a supervisor walk in on a cutter talking to a white guy writing down what he's saying is essentially presenting the cutter with his ticket back to his island.
Mm-hmm. You describe cutting sugarcane as the most perilous work in America. What makes it so dangerous?
More men are injured cutting sugarcane in America than at any other occupation in America, 40% of them. The next highest, according to OSHA standards, is 33%. So more injuries than in any other occupation.
Injured by the instrument that they used to cut the cane?
Mainly by the knife. A lot of very serious and permanently disabling back injuries, but most of it comes from the knife. Or second and third, or third and fourth, would probably be piercing your eardrum or your eye with a stalk.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe what the living conditions are like in the camps for sugarcane workers?
Well, it's living. The largest camps are simply huge cement barracks, cement floors, and rows of bunk beds up and down the walls. Terrifically hot. This is South Florida. No provisions whatever made to cool the place down. All there are small little fans that the cutters buy in town from their wages and set up beside their heads to blow some air, but there are no fans in the dorms or that the company provides, and no air conditioning. And otherwise, they conform to square footage requirements set forth by the government, so they're, you know, which is minimal.
So how many men are there per dorm?
It really depends on the camp. There are essentially two kinds of camps. One company has camps that are small cottages that jam about, 10 or 12 or 14 men into small little cottages, and then there are camps that have 2,000 or 1,400 men in the huge cement barrack warehouses, and there are also smaller versions of those where you'll find maybe 200 or 150 or 80.
You've painted a pretty grim picture about what it's like to work in the sugar fields of Florida. You've spoken to many West Indians who work there. What's a couple of the reasons that you heard directly from the men who work in the fields about why, for the moment, they're choosing that life?
Well, they don't have a choice. They aren't choosing it. As I put in my book, I said if there were any other possibility for them to work at home, it's clear they would never cut sugarcane. To live in Jamaica and Kingston is a very, in terms of financial circumstances, a very grim life. These people have no other choice but to do whatever they can do to get some work. And this at least offers the possibility of 6 months of work, which is a kind of unexampled piece of good fortune in Jamaica.
There been any attempts to unionize?
There hasn't been, that I know of, an attempt to actually unionize the cutters, because labor difficulties of any seriousness or intensity, the cutters solve by shipping home any of the cutters, hundreds at a time. In 1972, there was a strike at one of the companies involving Cuban tractor drivers that never really got, that was supported by the United Farm Workers Union, but never really got to involve the West Indians. And they don't really, there's no real way to get a toehold.
I wonder what effect you think that recent press on working conditions in the sugarcane fields, what effect that's going to have on working conditions there. For instance, there's your book, Big Sugar. Mm-hmm. There was recently a feature on West 57th mm-hmm. about working conditions there. You think that's going to have any effect?
Let's say I hope so. one doesn't know. I think that this business has operated in great secrecy for many years. It's a 19th century industry. In addition, of course, to simply the conditions of the field and what happens, they also receive this migrant worker program amounts to them in another form as another kind of government subsidy. These workers have no choice over what grower they'll work for, what farm they'll be assigned to. They're simply, it's like joining the army. You sign up and you're shipped out and you go where you're sent. This means that the growers never have to compete with each other for wage prices. It's a monopoly. So they've had a lot of reason to keep this terrifically secret. My book now is the first time that anybody has managed to get as much information over as long a period of time about the sugar business, and I would hope that when this kind of information gets out to other people, that this is a kind of thing that would not be kind of business practices that shouldn't be tolerated in America. I don't think it doesn't. I'm not in sympathy with the idea that the family that owns the two largest sugar corporations should be worth $500 million. The complaint is always made by the growers that they can't afford to pay more money for the harvest, but logical extension of that argument is that, do you mean to tell me that this family might, if they were forced to pay more for their harvest, might only be worth $498 million? $496? I mean, would that really be, is that really the side that one feels comfortable supporting? And I don't, and I certainly hope that something is done. This is a terrible, dreadful life that these men lead, full of suffering. And I find it distasteful that it leads to, on the other end of the spectrum, lives of unexampled prosperity.
Well, Alec Wilkinson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alec Wilkinson's book, Big Sugar, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing a reporter profile, actually, of Samuel Pierce, the former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, by Mara Liasson. Of course, his department has come under a lot of scrutiny with all the scandals that have become known since he left. Also, a talk with Governor Steve Cooper of Alaska. Tomorrow, Exxon pulls out and says the cleanup's over. We'll hear what the governor has to say about that. And a report on a speech last night by the Deputy Secretary of State, Lawrence Eagleburger, which spelled out our policy toward the Soviet Union. No aid for the Soviet Union until Mikhail Gorbachev's reforms are clearly permanent.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tracy Kidder's book, The Soul of a New Machine, won a Pulitzer Prize in 1982. It was about a team of electronics engineers who invented the minicomputer. Kidder's book, House, told the story of how four carpenters built an award-winning Greek Revival house in western Massachusetts while waging class warfare against the yuppie couple who commissioned it and the architect who designed it. In his new book, Among Schoolchildren, Kidder has entered the classroom. Critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Tracy Kidder has a gift for making people want to read about the kind of work they don't particularly want to do. In Among Schoolchildren, Kidder writes about teaching grammar school, a job that lacks prestige, pays poorly, and doesn't even offer the reward of a finished product. But Kidder becomes such a rapt apprentice that his fascination sparks our own. His book doesn't address most of the big questions about education. Instead, he chronicles a year in the life of one fifth-grade teacher, Christine Zajac, and he manages to confer dignity and mystery on the job that, as the saying goes, anybody can do. Kidder sits in on Mrs. Zajac's classes and often goes home with her and watches as she grades papers till midnight. One day, he even follows her to the principal's office, where she's about to discuss a learning-disabled boy with the boy's grandmother, who only speaks Spanish, and his transvestite uncle, who shows up in a leather miniskirt. As the year continues, Kidder learns the basic lesson that all teachers and school administrators know. It's very easy to be a bad teacher and very hard to be a good one. Kidder must have chosen the spunky 34-year-old Mrs. Zajac to be the focus of among school children because she's known as the Witch of Kelly School. She's one of those committed teachers who race against the calendar each year to cram as much learning into her students' brains as they'll allow. He chose Kelly School because its student body is unusually diverse. It's located in Holyoke, Massachusetts, a tired industrial town in the middle of the affluent Five Colleges area. Two-thirds of the kids need the free lunch program, while many of the remaining students have been sent there because their middle-class parents believe in public education. The combination of a terrific teacher with students from different economic backgrounds lets Kidder investigate whether public schools are the great equalizers that Horace Mann envisioned. Teaching tearjerkers like Up the Down Staircase and To Sir with Love have explored this theme before. But Mrs. Zajac's struggle is more absorbing than those of her fictional counterparts, and its outcome is more ambiguous. A brilliant student named Judith seems a sure bet for a scholarship until her family suddenly moves back to Puerto Rico. Then there's Robert, a self-abuser who gouges bloody furrows in his arms with pennies. Robert finally responds to Mrs. Zajac when he constructs an electric light for the school science fair, but his project is a mess of twisted nails and a light bulb with a busted filament. The prizes mostly go to the middle-class kids whose parents help them, and Mrs. Zajac decides that the only lesson the science fair teaches is that life is unfair. Despite these setbacks, Kidder emerges from his year in the classroom with a belief in the realistic possibilities of education. He says that good teachers put snags in the river of children passing by, and over the years they redirect hundreds of lives. Among school children will vividly remind most readers of the reasons why they don't want to teach, and it will deepen their respect for talented teachers who've reconciled themselves to the drawbacks of their jobs but aren't so easily satisfied when it comes to their students.
Maureen Corrigan is a veteran teacher now stationed at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. He also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Audrey Voblitis, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, social critic Barbara Ehrenreich looks at the professional middle class and its intellectual, political, and moral journey from the 60s to the 80s. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Sea of Love, starring Al Pacino and Ellen Barkin. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.